Dr. Hugh Ross.
Okay, how are we doing? All right. Well, you heard Mark talk about Montana. I recommend you go there in the summertime, because I've been up there in wintertime where it gets down to 60 below. So it only gets snow, it gets cold. But it is a beautiful place. In fact, I'm taking Kathy, my wife, to a mountaineering trip in August, and it's a place where they've got 4 weeks where it's not winter. So just 11 months of winter and 4 weeks where you can count on it not being winter. And yeah, the telescope I used in Canada, in northern Ontario, we would joke with the American astronomers that come up because they said, you only got one season here. I said, oh, no, we have four distinct seasons. We get 2 weeks of black flies, we get 2 weeks of mosquitoes, 2 weeks of horse flies, and 10.5 months of winter. So, I always apply for the coldest time, because when the temperature dropped below 45 below, that's when all the water vapor came out of the atmosphere, and literally the quality of my observations would go up 400%. So I let the Americans get all the nice time in the summer, I went for the really cold time, because that's where I got the really good observations. And it was fun, too, as I would walk from the place where we would sleep, the mile to the telescope. I remember one winter, every time I did that, this pack of six wolves would actually walk with me from the bunkhouse to the telescope. And they were very well fed. I wasn't worried about them. And they would just kind of walk with me about, 20, 30 yards away. And it was a place where the highest paid employee was the cook. He was paid twice as much as the director of the observatory because it was very isolated, and the only way they could get people to actually work there is if they had the cook of their choice. And he said, I'll work on a couple of conditions. You got to give me the vacation of my choice for 3 weeks out of the year, anywhere I want to go. And number two, I got an unlimited food budget. And he literally threw away half the food that, and the wildlife feasted on the food that he would throw away. And so I remember just outside the observatory, you could watch wolves and bears and deer and rabbits all eating from the same pile of food. And after they had eaten, they would play with one another. And I remember the squirrels would come down and annoy the wolves and get them to chase them. They'd run up the trees. And so it shows you what happens when the animal life is very well fed. But I remember this one bear. He was over 600 pounds. He had an obesity issue. So we kept trying to tell the cook, maybe we need to tone down a bit on the food that you throw away. Hey, enough of that. We are in the book of Isaiah. And if you didn't get the questions, these are the questions we're distributing on the book of Isaiah. And what we're doing in this class, if you haven't been with us in a while, and by the way, we are live streaming, so it's not just those of you here, there are people that are participating through live streaming. And to those of you that are watching us through live streaming, we are working on the lighting here. We realize this lighting is a problem for those of you trying to watch through your different computer devices and smartphones. So we are going to fix the lighting here and really enable you to be able to participate here with high-resolution video. But for the rest of you that are here, behave yourselves because you are on camera, okay? All right. But this is a class where you can ask a question anytime and any subject. So I am interruptible. But we are going through the major creation texts in the Bible, and particularly looking at what Isaiah's got to say. And it's already discovered Isaiah says a lot about science and creation. And we've looked a lot about what it says about the beginning of the universe. We're now looking at those passages to talk about the end of the universe and the end of humanity and what God's got in store for us. And the last week we ended up where I assigned different rows of different questions on the study sheet from question 6 through question 11. My apologies. I actually began to collect all the relevant scripture passages for the different questions. I found 35 fairly lengthy texts in Isaiah that just pertain to question number 6. So I realized it's simply not practical for us to get 5 questions done in one class. Now, what I've done for all of you is I've collected all the passages. So I'm going to hand this out. And hey, there's 51 copies here. There should be enough for everybody. And I'll bring another 50 next week because I know how you guys are. You forget to bring them with you. So we'll do that. But this actually lists all the scripture passages that will pertain to question number 6, which simply says, what does the book Isaiah say about the time of the end? So we'll be looking at that. We'll also be looking at what it says about the millennium. And incidentally, when it comes to the end of the universe, the millennium, and what's going to happen after the universe no longer exists, the book of Isaiah has got more to say about those subjects than any other book of the Bible. So that's why we're focusing on it. Moreover, you might say, shouldn't we just be focusing on what God created? Well, he's going to create again. He created the universe. That was the first creation. The second creation is the new creation. And this is what's really unique about Christianity. When you compare Christianity to, say, Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism or Mormonism or what the Jehovah's Witnesses teaches, those religions have in common that it's basically a one creation model, where you've got the one creation and God restores that creation. Christianity is distinct and it's a two creation model. And you really can't understand the science of the first creation without taking into account the science and the theology of the second creation. So that's what we're going to do. But it's often what happens in this class. I kind of tease you with a little scientific discovery. And this scientific discovery is not so little. It's quite major. And it just got published, literally just in the past few days. And this opening slide here, excuse me, let me turn this off. I'll try to remember to turn off the mic when I need to do that. Okay, this is an artist's rendition of what they think the first stars in the universe look like. And it's an artist's rendition because no astronomer has ever been able to see what they call a firstborn star. And because we've not seen firstborn stars, we've got atheists and especially young Earth creationists to say, the Big Bang creation model is wrong. Now, as you're familiar with Reasons to Believe, like 20 years ago, we put out a piece. In fact, what happened was I was approached by a well-known Old Testament Hebrew scholar who was fluent in Biblical Hebrew and basically encouraged me to put out there a paper basically pointing out how the Old Testament predicted all the fundamental features of Big Bang cosmology thousands of years before any astronomer even had a clue. And so he co-authored the paper with me because he says, look, I really am going to need to have your expertise in the Hebrew to do this. That was John Ray. And it's up on our website. You can find it. Big Bang, the Bible taught it first. And what the really taught was that the universe has a beginning. And I've never run into any scholar who doubts that, atheist or Christian. The Bible clearly teaches that the universe has a beginning. But what often they don't recognize is that the universe not only teaches that the universe has a beginning, that it has a beginning that includes a beginning of space and time itself. And you see this especially in the New Testament, where God speaks about what he was doing before he created time. The grace of God that we now experience was put into effect before the beginning of time, 2 Timothy 1:9. Or the hope that we share in Jesus Christ, Titus 1:2, was given to us before the beginning of time. And this really helps us with building a biblical creation model to recognize that the Bible repeatedly states that God begins his works of redemption before he creates anything. What was God doing before he created the universe? He was already putting into effect his works of redemption. Now, that implies, doesn't explicitly state, but it implies that everything that God creates is for the purpose of redemption. And I think I mentioned this last week. One of the things I've been doing with secular scientists that I encounter when I speak in university campuses is saying, if you will do your scientific research from a biblical redemptive perspective, you'll be more successful as a scientist. You'll be more successful in making scientific discoveries. And this is something you actually see in the Bible. Every major creation text in the Bible links the doctrine of creation with the doctrine of redemption. So those two go together. And in addition to the Bible saying that the universe has a beginning, that includes a beginning of space and time, it even more frequently states that the universe expands from that space-time beginning. Now, I've run into a fact. I've been doing debates with atheist scientists on my Twitter page, and they say, that's not in the Bible. Nowhere is that in the Bible. And I said, well, you're right. It's not in the book of Genesis, but it is in the oldest book of the Bible. Job 9:8 speaks about how God stretches out the heavens, but the verb there is the verb natah. In fact, what it says in Job 9:8 is that God alone is responsible for this expansion, making the point it was God's direct intervention that generated this expanded universe. And there are 10 other texts. And the book, in fact, we've already discussed this in the class, the book of the Bible that speaks most extensively about the expansion of the universe is the book of Isaiah. It actually speaks about how God expands the universe, like one would unfurl and stretch out a tent, making the fact that it's a surface effect. But in addition to that, the Bible states that the laws that govern the heavens and the earth do not change. Jeremiah 33:25, read the whole chapter. The whole chapter God is saying to the Jews, you change your mind all the time. You're always changing your mind. I'm a God that never changes. As evidence that I'm a God that never changes, look at the laws of physics I've set up to govern the universe. As they don't change, I don't change. And then what you see in the book of Ecclesiastes and the book of Romans and several other books, especially Proverbs, is that one of those laws that govern the universe is a pervasive law of decay. How everything is decaying. Galaxies are decaying. Stars are decaying. Our earth is decaying. The sun is decaying. And all of us in this room are decaying. Just take a look at one another. We're all undergoing ongoing continual decay. It's a pervasive law. But those are the four fundamental features of what we call the Big Bang creation model. That the universe expands from the beginning and the laws of physics that don't change, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, which implies that we must live in a universe that gets colder and colder in a highly predictable way. And I probably should show you the slide, I've done it before, where I basically show you, okay, given these four statements of what the Bible says about the universe, and given the age of the universe, what does the cooling of the universe look like? It's basically an exponentially declining curve. And astronomers now have 14 independent measurements of the past temperature of the universe, and guess what? They perfectly fit what the Bible predicted thousands of years ago. However, there are people who are pointing out, hey, no one's ever seen these firstborn stars. That's a crucial feature of Big Bang cosmology. A crucial feature of Big Bang cosmology is that the universe begins with only one element, hydrogen. And as the universe expands from the cosmic creation event, it spends about 20 minutes, between 3 minutes and 4 minutes after the beginning of the universe, where hydrogen is fused into helium. And you get about 25% of the hydrogen by mass being fused into helium. But that means that the first stars only got hydrogen and helium. And every star we look at, in addition to hydrogen and helium, has elements heavier than helium, like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, silicon. Every star we look at has these elements, and therefore you've got critics saying, where are the stars that have only hydrogen and helium? That's crucial to the Big Bang creation model. They're not there. Therefore, the Big Bang creation model somehow must be false. Matter of fact, I'll give you some quotes that have been published. And with this low lighting, one reason I'm hoping we get better lighting is so I won't have to put these on. But I'm at that age where this is necessary. Okay, a few quotes. These are from three different papers. And these are all from people who are critical of the Big Bang from a Christian perspective, in that they deny that the universe is more than 10,000 years old. Here's what they say. These original stars have never been observed, hence they were nothing more than hypothetical. And it goes on. Yet, namely, the Big Bang model vitally needs these population 3 stars, or there is no story. And that is correct. Another quote. Their existence of population 3 stars, referring to the firstborn stars, remains a matter of conjecture, not fact. And here's one that was put out by Jonathan Sarfati in a 400-page book critiquing the Big Bang. Quote, the total absence of these stars counts as a falsified prediction of Big Bang cosmology. Now, I can tell you, my peers in astronomy are very upset at these quotes. Why? Because they say the Big Bang model predicts that these stars will not be observable. Okay? They're saying, hey, we can't see them, but the model actually predicts that they're not going to be observable with present-day equipment. In other words, these stars are just simply beyond the access of telescopes. Why is that the case? The first-born stars, when did they form? About 100 million, 200 million years after the Big Bang creation event. The universe is 13.8 billion years old. How far away are those stars going to be? They're going to be about 13.6 billion light years away. We do not have a telescope powerful enough to image an individual star at that distance, let alone have the power to get a spectral measurement to tell us what the elemental composition of that star is. Now, there was one paper published where they looked at a galaxy that was just forming 13.5 billion light years away, where they basically measured the spectra of millions of stars and said we detected in that spectra that a good portion of those stars had no hydrogen and helium. However, the critics say you won't have a case until we get a spectrum of a single star. Okay, what I want to share with you today is that they now have spectral evidence that at least two of these stars must exist. And it's somewhat indirect, but it is basically establishing that the Big Bang got it right about what kinds of stars will exist and where they exist. And some Big Bang models predict that all the firstborn stars will be supergiant stars, meaning they're going to be more than 15 times bigger than our sun. And any star that's that big burns up really quickly. You say, what do you mean by quickly? A few million years or less. That's really quick for an astronomer, just less than a few million years. But that's fast enough that that star will only be visible if it's 13.6 billion light years away. Because if it were only a few million years and it was a firstborn star, it's going to have to be that far back in time, which means it's too far away for a telescope to pick up. However, there's a subset of these Big Bang models that predicts that in addition to the really big ones, you're going to get some small ones. The small ones won't be that numerous. The big ones will be more numerous, but there'll be a few of these small firstborn stars that'll be nothing but hydrogen and helium. Now, if they're smaller than 80% the mass of our star, the sun, they can keep burning for 13 billion years. Now, if they can burn that long, that means there might be some of them close enough that we can see them. And so this has been the basis of a search for the past decade to try to find nearby stars that have the signature of only having hydrogen and helium that are below this mass. But what's happened in the scientific literature, they said, no, wait a minute. If a star has been around for 13 billion years, it's going to pick up pollution from gas in other stars. And so the only way we're going to find a small star that's a firstborn star, if it's in a place where there's very little possibility of pollution from neighboring gas and stars. And so where they've been looking is in the extreme outer halo of our galaxy, where the density of gas is virtually zero and the neighboring stars are far away, which means that's a star that could actually exist for 13 billion years with very little pollution. Now, what do they mean by very little pollution? Well, where they only have, say, 0.001% of the elements heavier than helium than what our sun has. And they've actually found four stars that have that little bit of helium. And the study that this paper that just got published focuses on is this star with a very colorful name of HE 1327-2326. By the way, the vast majority of stars don't have names. They have license plate numbers like this. So the HE stands for the Discovery Instrument, and those other eight digits basically tell you where it is in the sky. 13 hours, 27 minutes right ascension, and it's minus 23 degrees, 26 minutes below the celestial equator. So that's how they come up with this. But it is a star that has a mass low enough that it could actually survive for 13 billion years. Moreover, when we measure the amount of iron relative to hydrogen, and that's a standard way that astronomers measure the quantity of elements heavier than helium, because iron typically tends to be the easiest spectral line heavier than hydrogen to detect. And what they discovered is it's it's 0.000025 of that of what's in the sun. 250,000 times fewer elements heavier than helium than what you see in the sun, which means it's gotten only a tiny amount of pollution. If this were a second-born star rather than a first-born star, it would have way more elements heavier than helium than what you see here. The other thing they notice is that the ratio of carbon to iron is quite high in this star, unlike the case for the other stars that are extremely deficient in elements heavier than iron. And so what these astronomers decided to do, they said, this looks like the signature you would get if you've got this newborn star that's small in mass that happens to be polluted by only one source, and that is another population 3 star or newborn star that comes in at 25 times the mass of the sun. And so stars that are this big, 25 times bigger than the sun, and they're only composed of hydrogen and helium, have a very high probability of exploding as a supernova. Now, your typical star that explodes as a supernova, it showers out radiation in a very spherical distribution. It basically, everybody gets it. But a star that has only hydrogen and helium, that's this massive, will explode in an asymmetrical manner, where you basically get two strong jets pointing out and nothing happening anywhere else. So you get these powerful jets coming out typically in two directions. And that's what this artistic rendition is demonstrating, is that the collapse of the star and the supernova explosion causes a cone of radiation to go out. And if you've got this small star with no hydrogen and helium that's in the same new forming galaxy and happens to be in the line of that jet, it's going to pick up a certain spectral signature. And the spectral signature has been modeled in detail in the lab and with computers. The problem is that signature shows up in the short ultraviolet part of the spectrum, which means you're going to need a telescope, a very powerful telescope, that's able to give you spectral lines in that part of the ultraviolet spectrum, which would basically reveal that this is the unique signature that you're seeing from a newborn star being exposed to another newborn star that's very massive and undergoes a supernova eruption and happens to have its beam of radiation focused on the small star. Okay, so what these astronomers did, somehow they got a huge chunk of time on the Hubble Space Telescope. Because it's in space, it can access the ultraviolet part of the spectrum. You can't do that with ground-based telescopes. Only a space telescope will do that, and only the Hubble Space Telescope is able, because after all, this is a star, very small, at the edge of our galaxy, which means it's faint. And so you're going to need a powerful telescope that can look at the ultraviolet radiation and look at it over a very long integration time to get the spectral lines strong enough that they can actually test their hypothesis. And somehow, they got 22 hours and 20 minutes of continuous integration time on this star with a Hubble Space Telescope. That's unheard of, to get that much time on the Hubble Space Telescope on one star. But because there's such a strong motivation within the astronomical community to come up with indisputable evidence for the existence of these firstborn stars, as the Big Bang creation model predicts, they got the time. And the thing got published just days ago, where they found seven spectral lines, and they were exactly, I mean, it was five iron lines, one silicon line, and one zinc line. And it was especially the zinc line that said, we can only get that line if indeed our hypothesis is correct, that this is a newborn star that was exposed to the supernova eruption from a really big newborn star. And so they published their paper, and bottom line is, we now know for certain that we found at least two newborn, or what we call population three stars. So affirming what the Big Bang model predicted all along. Now, also this past week, a news story was released basically saying, you may have been aware of this, is that the astronomical community has been wanting to put a super telescope on top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii, and has been delayed for 7 years because there's been Hawaiian natives saying, wait a minute, that's a sacred mountain. And, you know, this would upset our religious practices if we allow you to put a giant telescope on top of the mountain. And my astronomer friends have been mystified by these protests because it's like, well, wait a minute, there's already two dozen telescopes on top of the mountain, and we're talking about taking some of them down to make room for this big one. But for some reason, some of the native Hawaiians got upset about the size of this telescope. And they said, this is a sacred mountain. Astronomers, this has been a fight that's been going on for 7 years. They said, well, when have you been actually treating this mountain as a sacred site? We never see you up here. And well, there's nothing in your history that says that this was ever venerated as some kind of site, but apparently once the telescopes got up there, suddenly they said, this has religious significance. This has been a big battle going on. But what happened last week is that the government intervened and said, wait a minute, the astronomers have got a really strong case here. You're going to be able to come up on the mountain and do what you want to do in terms of your religious ideas. And so it now, construction's been approved. This super telescope will now be built on top of Mauna Kea. And we're talking a super telescope, we're not kidding. This is what it looks like. And to give you an idea of its size, that's a big semi-truck, that's an 18-wheeler there at the bottom. Okay, so it really is a big telescope. And we're talking 30 meters across the mirror. Over 100 feet across is the size of the mirror. And in order to make that work, you basically have to make a whole bunch of small mirrors and put them all together, as you see there. And so this will now be sitting on top of Mauna Kea. And actually, the background here is wrong. This is an artist's rendition. This is what it really looks like, where you're on top, there's snow on there. And incidentally, this is going to be set up with what they call laser ranging. And so it basically shows a laser beam going out there. You're not going to see it because they'll put the laser beam at a wavelength that's not going to interfere with the observations. But the whole idea is to have the super telescope having the same kind of definition capabilities of a telescope in outer space. And how they do that, they use a laser beam fired up to the atmosphere, and they figured out how the atmosphere is distorting the image of the telescope, and then they have a computer that basically takes out all those atmospheric distortions in real time. It's an incredible technology, but basically means you can get exactly the same kind of resolution you get in outer space with a telescope on the ground, basically using a computer and a laser to take out all the atmospheric disturbance of the image. And so your tax dollar is at work, but there's some private money involved in this as well.
Is that international?
Yes, it's an international effort. It's not just your tax dollars. A lot of other nations' tax dollars are going into this too. And actually, the real goal of the astronomical community is to have one in Mauna Kea and to have one in Chile, both of this size, so we can observe the whole sky with these new super telescopes. And one of the big motivations for funding this instrument is it will have very likely, not positively, but very likely have the telescope power to get a spectrum on a star 13.6 billion light years away. The James Webb telescope that's going to be going up into outer space will have the capability, but this telescope will have the capability as well. Now, before I take any, I'll take a couple of questions. Go ahead. Now, it won't be used as an interferometer because to make optical interferometry work, they've got to be relatively close together. Yeah, the baseline's too large. Works at radio astronomy wavelengths because there the atmosphere doesn't disturb the phase information, but at optical wavelengths, it really does. And there's a limit, too, to how much you can... I mean, it's great for measuring the diameters of stars. It's hard to get it to do much other than that. However, maybe we don't have to wait. We got a question at the back here. Go ahead. Yeah, wait for the microphone. That helps. The people
my question came thinking about the space, how far we are from the longest star. And my question is, when Christ left the disciples after he resurrected, he leaves space here.
Yes.
Now, how would you explain if the third heaven is so far away, where God lives or stays or habitates, whatever? I know that Paul or Peter went to the third heaven,
but Paul,
not
right?
Physically, of course. So how will you explain that Christ was able, having a body, go that far? I mean, it takes many years for us or any human. I don't think we can ever be able to attain.
Well, that's a question I got on Facebook about a few months ago. Was, hey, Jesus was raised bodily from the dead. The universe is, you know, 45 billion light years across minimum. And wouldn't it take him a long time to get to heaven? Or what about Paul when he was taken up to the third heaven? What people are overlooking there is that the third heaven, the spiritual realm where God dwells, where the angels dwell, is not part of the space-time dimensions of the universe. And so an analogy to think of, let me set this up. I'll just use this piece of paper. Let's assume we got people living in two dimensions where they got length and width only. They're flatlanders. They don't have any sense of height. Now, if they wanted to leave that dimensional realm and enter into our dimensional realm, they don't have to go very far. If they go 1 millimeter above their two-dimensional realm, they're in a different dimensional realm. Likewise, it could be that the dimensional realm that Jesus moved into or Paul moved into is really close. And so we shouldn't be thinking of them having to travel 13, 14 billion light years at the speed of light and taking, you know, those billions of years to get there. It can be done very quickly because there's a different dimensional realm. Questions I'm also getting is, well, where are heaven and hell? And didn't the Bible get it wrong when it said heaven is up and heaven is below? Well, again, go back to this analogy, a two-dimensional realm. And if you're talking to these two-dimensional beings from above, you'll say, I'm up here. But they think up is this way, or up is this way. They're not realizing it might be up in a completely different dimension. And as proof for that, notice the Bible tells us, in fact, Isaiah gets into this, is that when God speaks the universe out of existence, heaven survives and hell survives, which means they're not part of the space-time dimensions of the universe. They're in a different dimensional realm. Well, let me wrap this up so we can get into our Isaiah study. A paper got published just a day after this paper in the Astrophysical Journal was published saying, we now have positively identified two firstborn stars, one that we've seen and one that must have existed in order to explain the spectrum we see in the one that we can see. And yes, this gives further motivation to get this amazing instrument funded so we can begin to see millions of these stars and not just one or two. However, a group of Japanese astronomers said, it's going to be a while before this thing is up and running. We think we can see some of these stars right now. And the Japanese astronomers have a telescope on top of Mauna Kea. It's right next to the Keck telescopes. The Keck telescopes are two 10-meter telescopes. Right next to the two 10-meter telescopes is a Japanese 8.2-meter telescope. And this is what the facility looks like. And they published a paper basically making the point, if we can use the new technology on this telescope, it's a Subaru telescope. You can guess who helped funded it, okay? It's a Subaru telescope, but it's got the technology where they're able to make spectral measurements of stars. And basically what the paper's pointing out, if we can actually take advantage of a really big cluster of galaxies, distant clusters of galaxies act like gravitational lenses. I think you're all aware that general relativity predicts a massive body will bend light. That's how they first confirmed a theory of general relativity. They waited for a solar eclipse, and when they observed the solar eclipse, they noticed that stars right next to the limb of the sun changed in position. They moved out a little bit, basically showing that general relativity is true, that massive bodies will bend light as they go around them. Well, if you've got something like this, a really gigantic cluster of galaxies, it will bend light around it. And basically what these Japanese astronomers said, if we can take our Subaru telescope with this new technology and line it up so that we're actually using a gigantic cluster of galaxies as a gravitational lens, we can double or triple the power of our telescope. And we think we may be lucky enough that there happens to be one of these population three stars or firstborn stars directly behind the cluster of galaxies. We'll be able to image it with existing technology. And basically they published the paper this week saying, and basically this is a call for money, basically saying, we think this can work, give us the money, and we'll start doing the observations and see if we're lucky enough to pick up a star. You do have to be lucky, because the star's got to be directly behind the center point of the cluster of galaxies in order to get sufficient magnification to double or triple or quadruple the power of your ground-based telescope. So maybe we'll have more candidates than just the two that have been discovered by this European team that have published in the Astrophysical Journal. Any questions before we jump into Isaiah? Yes. Wait for the microphone.
So you mentioned that in the Big Bang creation model, that it was predicted that they won't be able to see these firstborn stars. But now that we can, well, I was thinking, how was it predicted? Who is it? You might have said, but who predicted it? And is it just because of its distance in light years?
That it's was the why distance, correct.
Okay.
How the Big Bang model predicts it, the Big Bang model says the universe starts with only one element, hydrogen. Within a 20-second window in the first 4 minutes, that hydrogen passes through a temperature window where it fuses into helium, and about 25% of that hydrogen will be fused into helium, which means the firstborn stars will be nothing but hydrogen and helium. And, trying to form a star where all you got is hydrogen and helium is difficult, not impossible, but difficult. But the whole point is, if this model is correct, where are these stars that have only hydrogen and helium? And the whole point is, well, if the model is correct, these stars will be extreme distances, or they're going to be small stars that have been polluted over the 13 billion years. And for talking in our vicinity, the pollution is so extreme, you can't tell whether they started off as having only hydrogen and helium. So what they're doing is they're looking for these small stars in the very outer fringe of our Milky Way galaxy, where they think the pollution, they've got good evidence that the pollution will be low enough that they can tell exactly where it got the elements. And in this case, this star, HE1327-2326, the pollution signature is exactly what you would expect if it got polluted by another firstborn star that was very massive, exploded, and the small star happened to be in the pathway of one of the jets of the explosion. It was literally a perfect match. So basically saying it has to be a star that started off with only hydrogen and helium, or was blasted by another star that started off with only hydrogen and helium. So that's the whole basis of it. But now people are saying maybe we can use existing technology if we can actually take advantage of these clusters of galaxies to act as a second telescope to enhance the power of our ground-based telescope. Or we wait till we got these super powerful telescopes. The James Webb is supposed to go up next year, and one of its first objectives is going to be to try to get a spectra of one of these extremely distant firstborn stars. But these ground-based telescopes may actually, they're much bigger telescopes, and if they can actually use this laser technology, that's probably a better way to go to try to find a whole bunch of these firstborn stars. And what's exciting about that, we'll be able to build a much more detailed Big Bang creation model. Because right now there's about a dozen different Big Bang models that predict different features of the firstborn stars. In particular, they predict how many are going to be really big, how many are going to be small, if any. And so that's really what astronomers are saying. We not only want to see these stars, we want to see their characteristics, because if we can discern their characteristics and their population sizes, then we can build a far more detailed model, which gives us more evidence. Let me close with this on this discussion before we get into Isaiah. Where I've been getting a lot of pushback from atheist scientists on my Facebook and Twitter page, they say, wait a minute, you're a 21st century astronomer. You're reading Isaiah, you're reading Job and Jeremiah and Zechariah, and you're pulling this out of the text, but you're pulling it with a 21st century bias. Did anybody actually see the Bible teaching these things before astronomers actually determine the universe has a beginning? It expands from that beginning, has constant laws of physics, or one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. Well, number one, astronomers didn't have that figured out until 1925. So the question is, are there any Bible authors previous to 1925 who are saying, this is what Isaiah, Jeremiah, Psalms, Job, and Zechariah are saying about the universe? The answer is yes. There were Bible scholars making those very points. Probably the one who has been most responsible for publicizing that is Gerald Schroeder, a Jewish physicist who's written a number of books on the Old Testament and the Big Bang. I don't agree with everything that Gerald Schroeder talks about. He's got a weird chronology for creation that he takes out of the Kabbalah rather than the Old Testament. But I do think he makes a very good point that Jewish theologians living 800, 900, 1,000 years ago were actually seeing that the Old Testament taught these things. And so I've had a number of physicists and theologians for that matter saying, show me where it says that. Well, Nicomedes, who lived 800 years ago, was the one who basically said, based on what I see in the Old Testament, the universe has to be expanding. So it's not just people with a 21st century bias that are seeing this in the text. And as John Ray pointed out to me, when you actually look at the 11 passages that talk about the expansion of the universe or the stretching out of the heavens, note that the verb natah is in all three Hebrew verb forms in the different texts, which means these are not metaphors or figures of speech. These texts are literally talking about a continuous expansion of the universe. If you want to see what he and I wrote, just go to reasons.org and the search engine, look for Big Bang, the Bible taught at first, or just Big Bang, it'll pop up. And you'll see what we wrote there. It's also in a couple of our books that are on the table. It's in The Creator and the Cosmos, as well as the book A Matter of Days. But you can read it for free on our website. Okay, into the Isaiah questions I gave you here. And in particular, let's jump into question six. What does Isaiah prophesy about the time of the end? Now, Isaiah is called one of the great prophets. And he, as we've already seen, predicted in detail a lot about what happened about the Messiah. And so it predicts future history, but it also predicts future science and predicts a lot about the future of the nation of Israel. Now, I made a mistake. I'm apologizing to you. I thought there were only about 20 passages that dealt with this subject. I went over it again yesterday afternoon and found there are 35. And so it's like, it's not going to work. I was going to have you kind of divide into rows and go over the different questions. At least for this question, I think we're all going to have to work on it together. Now, here's what I'm going to recommend. We got 6 rows here. Row 6 is going to join row 5, okay? Row 1, maybe we should have row 6 deal with row, because you only got 5 of you here in row 1. So, we got 6. Okay. But I want each row to take 7 passages of the handout I gave you. This handout. Okay. Let's start with the back row. And they're going to do the first 7 texts on the back. The next row, we'll pick the next 7. And basically, there's 35 here. We got 6 rows. 2 rows will join together. I'm going to give you each row as the assignment of looking at those 7 texts, and then I want you to feedback what you discover from those texts, because it really is mind-blowing what you see here in the book of Isaiah. And what you're going to see is that he repeats things to really drive home the point, this indeed is what I'm saying is going to happen when God's work of redemption begins to come to a close. And all these passages are in that context. What's going to happen to humanity? What's going to happen to earth? What's going to happen to the nation of Israel? What's going to happen to the Gentile community? I want you to notice is everybody thinks the Old Testament is a book only for people that are blood descendants of Abraham. Notice how frequently Isaiah includes the Gentiles, those that are not blood descendants. But it's basically making a point, when the redemption of the Gentiles and the Jews is complete, these are the things that are going to happen. So look at it from that context. I'm going to give each row 10 minutes. See what you can pull. All you got to look at is those 7 texts. So pick out your 7 texts. I'll give you 10 minutes, and then we'll report back what you've discovered. And okay. Back row is going to do the first 7. Row against the wall. Your row, which is the second row from the wall, is going to do question or verses 8 through 14. And then the row in front of you is going to do 15 to 22. And then the next row is going to do. And what I'm going to do is combine the first 2 rows because it's underpopulated. That's the way it is in every church, right? The back rows always have the most people. So we'll put the first 2 rows together. You're going to be doing number 20. 8 through 35. Yeah, you need to kind of gather together somehow. You know, close fellowship isn't a bad thing. All right, have you had some fun doing this study? Okay, it's been enjoyable. All right. In view of the time, we've got a question from the live streaming audience that I'm going to take, and then I'm going to have you remember everything you've discussed. I'm going to have you report next week, okay? And here's what I'm saying. If you didn't get to finish the study of your seven passages, you've got a whole week to finish it. And my guess is you've actually gotten through five or six of them, right? Which means you only have to do one more. Come back next week. Remember what group you're in, and let's be ready to share what you've discovered, all right? And we'll just go through these one at a time that you see up here. And I'll try to bring more copies of those sheets as well. But the question that came in over the internet was, how do you explain all this effort on SETI? How many of you have ever heard of SETI? Okay. It's an acronym that stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligent Life. And yes, this has been going on since 1960. That was the first effort I can recall where Frank Drake actually got time on a telescope to try to listen to signals from these extraterrestrial intelligent aliens. And the question is, you know, they've done dozens of these studies, some to very high sensitivity. They've never heard anything. Why do they keep looking for these signals? And I can probably put it this way, because when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto some four decades ago, we had both Frank Drake come and Carl Sagan, who were really big-time promoters of searching for extraterrestrial intelligent life. And I recall particularly Carl Sagan making the point, yes, this is a long shot, but if we were actually to discover intelligent signals from another alien civilization, that would be the greatest discovery any human being could possibly make. So even though it's a long shot, we think it's worth investing lots of telescope time and tax dollars and donation dollars towards this effort. Because what could be a bigger discovery? And this is how Carl Sagan phrased it. He said, there must be some intelligent civilization out there that has composed an Encyclopedia Galactica, and they're broadcasting it throughout the universe as a message of how organizations of civilizations like ours can solve all their problems. And his whole point was, the human species here on Earth is in trouble. Look at what we're doing to one another. We have all these wars. We're polluting ourselves. What we need is the message from this Encyclopedia Galactica to solve all of our problems. And therefore, it's worth whatever it takes to try to get this message of how we can save ourselves from our own folly. Now, there were about 20 graduate students and another 20 professors in the astronomy department that were listening to Carl Sagan's mini course that he was teaching. And by the way, that wasn't part of the subject matter for the course. That was just an add-on that he threw in there. But I remember nudging my fellow graduate students and saying, don't we already have an Encyclopedia Galactica from an alien beyond the universe? And maybe we just need to be focusing our attention on what we already got. Carl Sagan overheard me. He says, I know exactly what you're talking about. But he says, there's no way anyone can live up to the moral standards of that Encyclopedia Galactica. That's the very point of this Encyclopedia Galactica. None of us, in our own strength, can live up to the moral standards of this book. We need help from the one that created the whole universe. But instead, we have all these astronomers who are looking for that same help from some intelligent civilization on a planet far away. Now, I've been engaging. A number of my friends are part of this SETI search, and what I've noticed is they're spending your dollars focusing their telescopes on these planets that they think might be radiating signals out there, but they're looking at planets orbiting stars that we already know are not candidates to host a planet with civilization on it. Now, trying to image a planet is extremely difficult. Trying to discern the properties of a planet, even if they're close by, is extremely difficult. but it's not difficult to discern the properties of stars. They're very bright. And we've looked at tens of millions of stars trying to find one that's sufficiently like the sun that it could be a candidate to have a planet orbit it on which advanced life is possible. And a 60-year search, guess how many such stars we have found that are candidates? Yeah, we got just one, the one that we're orbiting. It's the only candidate. And so my challenge to my friends that are part of the SETI program is, instead of trying to focus on these planets, look for a star. Until you find a star that's sufficiently like the sun to be a candidate, there's no point wasting valuable telescope time. Just like I mentioned, 22 hours and 20 minutes were necessary telescope time, the Hubble Space Telescope, to get a spectrum of this faint star. If we spend too much time looking for these intelligent signals from planets orbiting stars we already know are not candidates, that's a lot of valuable telescope time that's going down the drain. And so that, by the way, is the reason for a number of my peers strongly objecting to the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. They're not so much worried about your tax dollars, they're worried about their telescope time. Just that, hey, time I want in the telescope I can't get because they're looking for these signals they already know are impossible. However, it's the religious fervor of these SETI people that's really driving this whole thing, figuring out, okay, we got to get this Encyclopedia Galactica. That's why I think we need to be telling these astronomers, why don't you read the one we already have? And then we can go from there. In the back. Yes. Wait for the microphone.
Yeah, I was just making an observation of the Democrat from New York, Ocasio-Cortez. The world is going to end in 12 years.
Well, that is an interesting point, by the way, about extraterrestrial intelligent life. In terms of the technology that we developed after World War II, a number of papers have been published saying that's simply not sustainable on a single planet for very much time. About the maximum time you can sustain a civilization with a reasonably high population, you say, what's reasonably high? 1 billion intelligent beings on one planet with a civilization as advanced as what we had after World War II or more advanced, the limit's about 2,000 years. After that, you basically run out of resources. So we've been doing great because it hasn't been that long since the end of World War II. But yeah, time's coming when we're no longer going to be able to sustain our level of a civilization. That applies not only to us, it applies to every other possible intelligent civilization. The significant point about that, and one thing I got to thank my friends that are part of the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, is they've done very exhaustive searches for the planets that were within 250 light years of us and basically said, we know for certain there's nothing as advanced as we were at the end of World War II within 250 light years of us. Now, we were talking before class about how do you explain this huge resurgence of UFO sightings that's going on. And you know the number one explanation for the UFO sightings, which I disagree with, is we're being visited from aliens from another planet. Well, what SETI has told us is this. If that is the case, they have to travel more than 250 light years. And if we're talking beings like this inside of a spaceship, they can't go very fast. It's not like what you see on Star Trek. If you move your spaceship too quickly through interstellar space, you'll destroy it by encounters with electrons, protons, and other things that are in interstellar space. You've got to slow your craft down in order to keep the beings on board alive. You say, what's the maximum speed possible, given the laws of physics? About 1% the velocity of light. If it's 1% the velocity of light, how much time does it take to traverse 250 light years?
2,500 years.
Yeah. 25,000 years it takes to make it. Well, 25,000 years exceeds the maximum time window in which you can sustain. And incidentally, the time window gets shorter and shorter as the space gets smaller and smaller. If you're talking a spaceship, it's not going to be 2,000 years. It's going to be a lot less. And by the way, you can anticipate that after four or five generations on board that spaceship, the great-great-grandchildren may not be so excited across interstellar space. They may want to go back home. So, and they've already done experiments, by the way, of putting human beings in the equivalent of a small spaceship isolated from everybody else. Guess how long they last?
6 months.
6 months is the maximum before they lose their insanity, or lose their sanity to a point where they're unable to function. And incidentally, right at time, women function much better than men. We don't want to send men on long distance. You want to send women because they can maintain their sanity for a longer period of time. But you don't want to send women astronauts either. If they're high-tech, type A personalities with a strong motivation to learn, they're not going to last long. You want to send basically women who just love talking to one another about all kinds of different things, where they're all strangers to start with. They'll last about 6 months. Say, how long do male astronauts last? 1 month. So, yeah. So don't volunteer to be put in a capsule isolated from the rest of human beings. It's not good for your sanity. All right, we're out of time. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this amazing book, Isaiah. Lord, as we think about what Isaiah went through in order to give us his prophecy, it gives us pause about the prophets that you raise up to serve you. Lord, thank you for the suffering he was willing to endure. Thank you for his perseverance in the communicating this prophecy over a 60-year period. And Lord, we thank you how much of it is relevant to those of us alive today in the 21st century. Father, we pray that as we continue to study these last few questions we have on the book of Isaiah, it would really transform the way we engage people within the body of Christ and outside the body of Christ. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.